Okay. All right, so this is file 241, May 21st, 231, and we're going to jump into the middle of respiratory physiology. And don't forget, chapters 13, 14, 16, and 17 on the test, but including also one diagram from chapter 20. That's on your last test. All right, so let's get to respiratory physiology. And I think we were just getting to the aspects of ventilation, physical aspects of ventilation, I believe. Yep, that's where we were. Okay, so let's look at that. One and one, see if I can get a cursor going. Okay. All right, so ventilation results in pressure changes in different parts of the lung. Okay, because we know that a fluid, and the gas is a fluid, will flow from high pressure to low pressure, just like a solute will move from high concentration to low concentration. All right, so air moves in and out of the lungs from a high pressure to low pressure, so the pressure in your lungs has to change in order for air to move in and out. There's a couple other considerations, and that is compliance, elasticity, and surface tension influence ventilation. And we want to be familiar, okay, with these different kinds of concepts. Question?
Yeah, I think that we need to know the thoracic cavity.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, let's go over that. That's some nice anatomy right there. So we have a nice, what kind of section is this? What kind of section does that look like? Transverse. Yeah, I heard somebody say transverse. Extra credit for whoever that was over there. I'm not sure who that was. But anyway, nice transverse section. And oh, and here we can see nice transverse section right at the base of the heart through the tips of the lungs. But primarily what we're looking at here are the serous membranes around these visceral organs. And what can you tell me about a serous membrane? It's different than a mucous membrane. Okay, mucous membrane just lines a cavity that's open to the outside world, but a serous membrane does what? Lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world, all right, and it has a number of different components. How many components does a serous membrane have? It's got three, right? It's got three. So let's look at those three components, and in particular, let's look at the lungs. And the cavity that the lungs are in specifically are called the, or what cavity is that? The, you could say thoracic cavity, you're right, but I want the smallest cavity. It's the pleural cavity. Right, pleural cavity. So we're going to look at the pleural membrane, the pleural serous membrane. All right, we said three divisions. Well, here I have the lungs. And right on the surface of the lungs is the first division of a serous membrane. And you can count from superficial to deep. I'm just starting right on the organ. All right, so the lung is a visceral organ because it's inside a body cavity. And so the membrane right on top of it, right on its superficial surface, is the visceral pleural membrane, or the visceral pleura, right? And it covers the complete surface of the lung, and when it gets to this region right here, it folds back on itself and then attaches to the wall of the thorax. All right, so it's really the same membrane, it's just located in two different spots. Since it's in two different spots, we give it two different names. And the name of the membrane on the wall of the body cavity is what we call the parietal division of that serous membrane. And since it's the pleural membrane, we call that the parietal pleura membrane right here. So visceral is on the surface of the organ. The parietal division is on the wall of the cavity, whatever cavity that is. And we're looking at the thoracic cavity. So that's two. And what about the third? Yeah, it's that cavity filled with serous fluid. So if you want to think of serous fluid as the third component or the serous cavity, right, then that works for me too. All right. Now, this serous fluid in this serous cavity, in the pleural cavity right here, is a little bit different than the fluid that's inside an alveolus. And I think we talked about that fluid inside an alveolus, is that it is water, okay? And what can you tell me about water? Is it slippery or sticky? It is indeed sticky, right? So that an alveolus would not be able to inflate or expand because the water tension would keep an alveolus all glued together, Right. So what has to be secreted into the surface or onto the surface of an alveolus to disrupt that surface tension that will allow an alveolus to expand? Otherwise, it's going to be glued together with that water in there. Water has to have something. Yeah, surfactant, right? And so it's like a detergent. It makes water slippery so that the sides of an alveolus slip apart and can inflate. All right. Now, in this pleural cavity right here, there is no surfactant. There's just basically a water solution. So what does that mean? What does that mean if there's a sticky substance between the thorax wall and the surface of the lung? Yeah, they're stuck together, right? And so if we increase the volume of the thoracic cavity by expanding the ribcage laterally, okay, and anteriorly, it's also going to pull on the surface of the lung and expand the volume of the lung as well, okay? So different fluids in your body have different physical characteristics depending on how they have to function. In this particular case, the lung should be glued to the thorax wall, all right? But an alveolus, one alveolus wall should not be glued to the opposite side of an alveolus because then it can't inflate. All right, so there is no surfactant in the pleural cavity. All right, so that's, I think, pretty much what we are talking about here on this slide. The only other definition that probably would be good, this intrapleural space, right, is the space between the lung and the wall of the thorax, right? Intrapleural space. And we're going to look at a pressure in this space, and we're going to call that the intrapleural pressure. All right, we're going to look at three pressures, and it could be a tongue twister unless you have a nice picture in your mind. All right, so intrapleural means what? That space between the lung and the thorax wall. All right, and again, air moves from high pressure to low pressure. The lung is compliant. That means small changes in pressure can produce what change in volume if there's something highly compliant? Think of a balloon as opposed to your tire on your car. When you change the pressure in the balloon a little bit, what happens to it? It changes size quite a bit, right? But if you were to try to blow air into your tire on your car, you could increase the pressure a little bit, okay? But what about the size of the tire? It's not going to change because it's not compliant. Your lungs are compliant so that small changes produce large changes in volume. The other thing about the lung is that they're elastic. Which means what? If you stretch something out and let go, what happens? It goes back to its original length. So if you inflate the lungs, which is like stretching it, and then relax, guess what happens to the lungs? They go back to their original size, which will be smaller. Okay. And, of course, don't forget about that surface tension, right? Because we were talking about that. Well, we're going to have to talk about that again a little bit. All right, so here are some definitions. The intrapulmonary pressure, the intrapleural pressure, but guess what? We already defined what the intrapleural pressure was. What was the intrapleural pressure? It's the pressure in where? Between the lungs and the wall of the thorax, right? So it's in this little space. I can hardly point to it. So that's the intrapleural pressure. The intrapulmonary pressure is the pressure inside an alveolus, right? So it's inside the lungs. All right, and here we say that the visceral and parietal pleurae normally adhere to each other because why? Because there's no surfactant in this space so that the lungs remain in contact with the chest wall all the time under normal conditions. And so the lungs expand and contract with the size of the thoracic cavity. All right, so it's just that sticky water in that serous space between the cavities. Oh, look right here, sticky. Who used that? Intrapleural space. Yeah, nice. Okay, we'll skip over that. Okay, so during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is about -3 millimeters of mercury. And that -3 right here means that it is below atmospheric pressure, 3 millimeters of mercury below atmospheric pressure, which typically we're going to define to be constant and at 760 millimeters of mercury. All right, so during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure, which is the pressure inside the lungs, right, decreases. All right, so it's high on the outside, low inside your lungs, so which way is air going to flow? From high to low or inside your lungs as a result of that. All right, during expiration, the intrapulmonary pressure, pressure inside your lungs, is about 3 millimeters of mercury greater than atmospheric pressure. So instead of 760, then it's what? 763. So it's higher inside your lungs compared to the air in your room. So on expiration, which way does air move? High pressure to low, high pressure in your lungs, out into the air, which is relatively lower pressure. Okay, transmural pressure is just a difference between the intrapulmonary pressure and intrapleural pressure. That's what keeps the lungs inflated. All right, so what is that? Intrapulmonary is the pressure inside the lungs. The intrapleura is that space. All right, so if we subtract, all right, the intrapleura from the intrapulmonary, that should always be a positive number. The intrapulmonary pressure should always be higher than the pressure inside that space. So we're going to look at that, okay? But the bottom line of that is that keeps the lungs inflated. We're going to look at some abnormal situations. All right, so here are all of these numbers. On inspiration, we said, what, the intrapulmonary pressure is below atmospheric pressure? All right, and but on expiration, it's higher than atmospheric pressure, so it switches by 6 millimeters of mercury. All right, the intrapleural pressure is minus 6 on inspiration. Right, now, what is that like, okay, compared to the intrapulmonary pressure? It is lower. So the pressure inside the lungs is actually pressing into that intrapleural space, and it's pressing the lungs up against the thorax wall. And the difference between these two numbers is 3 millimeters of mercury. So even though there's relatively low pressure in the lungs, drawing air into the lungs, there's still even less pressure in the intrapulmonary space, so that the lungs still keep pushing out on the superficial walls of the lungs to help make sure that the lungs stay in contact with the thoracic cage, in addition to that sticky water that's in that serous fluid. All right, let's look and see what happens on expiration. So on expiration, where do we have to have high pressure to get air out of our lungs? Inside, yeah, the intrapleural or the intrapulmonary pressure has to be higher than atmospheric, and indeed it is. Right, the intrapleural pressure in that serous space is still minus, right? And we add these together, we see that the intrapulmonary pressure is still higher, obviously, than the intrapleural pressure. So the pressure inside the lungs is still pushing the lungs out up against the sides of the thoracic cavity as a result, right? And we see that it's even at a higher pressure, so it's even pushed up against the thoracic wall, even to a greater, twice as much on expiration compared to inspiration. All right, so notice that these pressures right here are above or below atmospheric pressure. What would you use for atmospheric pressure? What number would you like to use? Yeah, 760 at some standard temperature, okay, and humidity and all that kind of stuff. Here's a pretty important law, and it's pretty easy to see. It just says that pressure is equal to 1 over the volume. So what's the relationship between pressure and volume? It's inversely related, right? So if the pressure increases, what happens to volume? It's got to decrease. Or, for instance, if the volume decreases, what happens to pressure? If the volume increases, pressure decreases. Volume increases, pressure decreases because of that nice inverse relationship. So the volume inside the lung is what we're talking about, and also pressure inside the lung is what we're thinking about. All right, so this implies that changes in the intrapulmonary pressure, intrapulmonary is what, the pressure inside the lungs, occurs as a result of a change in lung volume. And remember that the lung is highly compliant, right? So changes in volume will make differences in pressure as well. All right, so an increase in lung volume. So if we increase lung volume, what happens to the intrapulmonary pressure? It decreases. That causes inspiration. All right, but if we go the other way, a decrease in lung volume, so if we decrease lung volume, what happens to pressure? In particular, the intrapulmonary pressure. It increases, and that causes expiration as a result. So we're going to be interested in looking at lung volumes because that's what controls the pressure differences. Okay, so don't forget that the lungs are highly compliant. Okay, there are some disease processes that reduce the compliance of lung tissue, and that makes breathing very difficult, and a person has way reduced pulmonary function as a result of that. Maybe we can talk about some of that stuff. Elasticity, really good picture in your anatomy book that shows that elastic network around every alveolus, but it's not in your textbook. Maybe you could go back to the anatomy textbook and just get a picture in your mind of what that elastic framework is that surrounds every alveolus. All right, but we said that what? That's the tendency of those alveoli to return to their initial size after they're expanded after inspiration. Okay. So that's good. Surface tension, oh gee whiz, I think we talked about all this stuff already to a pretty large degree. All right. Probably you should know the name of the cell that secretes surfactant. Was that on your diagram that we looked at last time? There's an alveolar type 1 cell and an alveolar type 2. One of those makes up the wall of the alveolus, the other makes the cell that secretes surfactant. Type 2 secretes surfactant. Type 1 is just a simple squamous cell that makes up the part of the respiratory membrane inside the alveolus. Okay. All right, so I don't think we're going to go over this law of Laplace in great detail. I don't think you have to understand the mathematics, and I won't have you do any calculations. But I do want to tell you a little bit about how this would work. All right, so let's consider that here are the lungs, right? The right and left lung. And let's just say that the lungs are not secreting surfactant. So there's no surfactant in this particular case. What would happen when we were to inhale? Well, if we were to inhale and the alveoli had no surfactant in them, as soon as one alveolus started to expand a little bit, then it would expand faster than any other alveolus in your lung. And you have 300 million other alveoli. So if you can started to inspire even more, right, that one single alveolus would, what, expand more at the expense of all those other 299 million, you know, 99 million. And eventually, at the end of inspiration, that one alveolus would take up the whole volume inside your lung, and all the other alveoli would remain closed because they're stuck together with that surfactant, right? So that would not work because you'd have very little surface area compared to the volume of that one alveolus that completely filled up your thoracic cavity. So that would be terrible. So what surfactant does is that it makes sure that all alveoli expand at the same rate, so they fill with the same amount of air, right? And that just improves oxygen transport from the air into the blood and CO2 from the blood back into an alveolus. All right, so that surface tension is reduced with surfactant, and if it's not reduced, basically only one little part of your lung would expand, not all of the alveoli. So that's hugely important. Oh, here are the cells that I was talking about. Okay, I thought we looked at this slide already. So I see the nice respiratory membrane right here. I see a layer of surfactant. I see a alveolar type 1 cell, which is the simple squamous epithelium that makes up the alveolus, a little interstitial space, and then the wall of the capillary. And that's also an epithelium. How would you characterize this epithelium that makes up the wall of this capillary? It's just a simple squamous, right? So simple squamous here, simple squamous there. Those epithelia are specialized for exchange across the surface of those cells, from the apical surface right to the basal surface. And here is the type 2 cell that secretes surfactant to make sure that all alveoli expand at the same rate so that your whole lung expands on inspiration, not just one little alveolus or one little component, one little part of your lung. Okay. Some people don't secrete surfactant as adults. We call that acute respiratory distress syndrome. And then they just have to be put on oxygen because they have decreased pulmonary function. And also premature babies, especially if they're born by cesarean section, because those alveolar type 2 cells become activated when the infant experiences stress. And the normal delivery produces a lot of stress on the infant, which activates those type 2 cells to secrete surfactant. But if it's a relatively easy delivery, at least for the infant, during a cesarean section, then those type 2 cells don't become activated, and the infant is born with an inability to inflate the lungs completely. Okay. All right, so that's the importance of surfactant. Okay, so here I see a couple plain film x-rays of the thoracic cavity. The top picture right here shows the size of the thoracic cavity at rest before inspiration or before inhalation, and we can outline what the volume, at least in these two dimensions, are. So these lungs are relatively small, Right? After inspiration, we have to change the size of the thorax, making the thorax bigger, the thoracic cavity bigger, which makes the pleural cavities bigger. Right? And then after inspiration, the bottom figure shows what the volume of the lungs would be like after inspiration. Right? The dotted line is before, and here is the edge afterwards. And you can see, indeed, that during inspiration, the volume of the lungs increases. And because of Boyle's law, right, as the volume increases, what happens to this pressure, the intrapulmonary pressure? It decreases, right, compared to atmospheric pressure. So air flows into the lungs just passively as a result of that. Okay. There are some muscles that are primarily important for inspiration. The most important one is this diaphragm right here. Nice separation between the thoracic and abdominal cavities. That's probably how you first ran into it, because it made life really simple to know these cavities in anatomy. When the diaphragm contracts, okay, it goes from this dome-shaped muscle to more of a rectus muscle, which means straight. And when it straightens out, okay, it pulls the lungs inferiorly, but it also increases the volume of the pleural cavity by the amount that it gets pulled downward. Right? So for inspiration, the diaphragm works the most. It decreases the pressure inside the lungs, so air flows in. Okay. All right, some of these other muscles that we've talked about, or that you've learned about in anatomy, for instance, like external intercostals. I don't think we talked about the parasternal intercostals, but they're kind of like cousin muscles to these external intercostals. And the scalenes and sternocleidomastoid, because they pull on the first rib right here. So when they maintain, right, it just gives this a spot for these external intercostals to pull against. Right? And so the external intercostals is pulling the rib cage out and anteriorly. So muscles for inspiration are these external intercostals, right? And the externals are antagonistic to the internal intercostals, right? So this is a little bit strange. They're named by their location, right? External means superficial, internal means deep between the ribs. It just so happens that these superficial intercostal muscles, the external intercostals, cause what? Inspiration. And the internal intercostals cause expiration. Okay, so there's a kind of almost like a misnomer, but they're not named by the function of them, they're just named by their location. Okay, now, during expiration, right, all these muscles do have elastic properties, right? And there is elastic property in every alveolus. So when these muscles relax, right, they go back to their original location. So then the diaphragm goes from a straight muscle to this big curved or dome-shaped muscle. And when it does, that decreases the volume of the pleural cavities, right? That decreases the volume. And if it decreases the volume, what happens to the pressure inside the lungs? It increases above atmospheric pressure. So there are actually two kinds of breathing. And what we're looking at right here is a kind of breathing that we call quiet breathing, which is what you all are doing right now because you're not exercising. You're just inspiring, right? And then you relax these muscles and you expire. So inspiration is an active process requiring these skeletal muscles, but expiration during quiet breathing just happens passively, right? So the pressure inside your thoracic cage increases to expel air because of all the elastic properties of skeletal muscle and elastic properties of the lungs. But now, if you were to start exercising, you would have to increase your ventilatory rate. You'd have to breathe faster. And under those circumstances, the elastic properties of the muscles and the lungs would not be able to keep up with how fast you have to breathe. All right, so there's a different kind of breathing. We call that deep breathing. Right, for deep breathing, for inspiration, you still need the diaphragm. Okay, you still need the external intercostals and parasternals, just like for quiet breathing. But now for expiration, you need some other muscles to decrease the size of the thoracic cavity. All right, let's start with these abdominal muscles. All the abdominal muscles contract, right? Like the transverse abdominis, internal, external oblique, rectus abdominis contract. All right, and that pressurizes the abdominal cavity so that abdominal organs push up against the diaphragm, right, helping to increase the rate at which the diaphragm goes back to its original shape, which is dome shape. And that decreases the size of the thoracic cavity quickly. Right, the other muscles that are important are the internal intercostals. Right, they will pull the rib cage down instead of out and up. And when they pull the rib cage down, again, that decreases the size of the thoracic cavity. And when the size decreases, the volume decreases, that increases the pressure and air is expelled from the lungs. All right, so during quiet breathing, inspiration requires the diaphragm that's active. During deep breathing, the same thing. We need muscles for inspiration. The big difference is expiration. For quiet breathing, it's completely passive. Muscles just have to relax. But when we need to increase our rate of ventilation, then we need to recruit some of these muscles to speed things up. So there are muscles used for expiration, for deep breathing. It is an active process. So deep breathing, expiration is active. Deep breathing for, no, quiet breathing for expiration is passive, as long as you have normal, healthy lung tissue. Okay, so here is a pretty good slide. I think I modified this because there's an error on the slide. Let's go over some of these pressures. I don't know what slide I gave you guys. Look at atmospheric pressure here. We have 769 millimeters of mercury. Okay, does that make sense? Absolutely not, right? What number should be here? Look at your figure in your notes. 760, right? It should be 760, and that's going to be constant. So I changed it here. But over here on this slide, we got 760 here, right? So in some places, it's correct, and in some places, it's wrong. So I changed it so that it makes sense. Atmospheric pressure in the air that we're breathing is constant at 760. Intrapulmonary pressure is what? The pressure inside the lungs, right? So at rest, air is neither going in or going out. All right, so what can you tell me about the pressure difference between the intrapulmonary pressure and atmospheric pressure if air is not going in or out? Yeah, it's the same, right? Just like for diffusion. If the concentration is the same in two locations, there's no diffusion. All right, at rest, now let's look at that intrapleural pressure. It's 756, which is lower or greater than both atmospheric pressure and intrapulmonary pressure. It's less. Right, and so because there is that positive pressure from the intrapulmonary to the intrapleural spaces, the lungs are always pressed up against the wall of the thorax because that intrapleural space is acting like a little bit of a vacuum, right, to suck the lung tissue right up against the wall of the thorax. Okay, so that's at rest. Now, what do we need to do to inspire? How does air get inside our lungs? Yeah, by increasing the volume. So what happens to pressure then? It decreases. Can I see that? Oh, I can almost see it. These lungs look bigger than these over here. I never noticed that before, but that has to be the case. All right, so that during inspiration, we see that because of Boyle's law, the intrapulmonary pressure goes from 760 to 757. Not a big difference, but we saw that to be what? 3 millimeters of mercury in that table. It's hard to really appreciate numbers in a table, so I think this is nice to look at. All right, so what happens to air now? If the intrapulmonary pressure is 757, atmospheric is 760, air goes from high to low, so air goes inside the lung, but don't forget, we need to keep the lungs expanded. We don't want it to collapse because those elastic tissues will want to collapse a lung. And what helps prevent that? Well, let's look at that intrapleural pressure, and it is 754. What's that like compared to the intrapulmonary pressure? It's less than, right? And so that helps maintain the association of the parietal and visceral membranes right here so that the lungs don't collapse. Because this pressure right here is lower than inside the lungs, so the lungs are always pressing up against the wall of the thorax. All right, so let's now look at expiration. The volume of the lung changes, right? So we see a decrease in volume. Here it is at end inspiration, and now, right, during expiration, because of, those elastic properties that we were talking about, the lungs collapse. And let's look at the pressures. the volume decreases, right? So what happens to pressure inside the lungs, the intrapulmonary pressure, if the volume decreases? Inversely related, right? Pressure goes up. It goes up to 763, which is what? Higher than atmospheric pressure, so air flows out of the lungs. But we still want to make sure that the lungs stay in contact, that the visceral and pleural membranes stay in contact with each other. So the intrapleural pressure has to still be lower than the intrapulmonary pressure, and indeed it is. Right? So the lungs still stick to the walls of the thorax because that intrapleural pressure is less than the intrapulmonary pressure. All right, but now let's think of a different circumstance. Let's just say this person became a patient, experienced some kind of trauma, and he had his thorax perforated with some kind of something, maybe a bullet, maybe an arrow, maybe a piece of rebar during an accident or something, car accident. All right, so if there's a perforation that goes from, all right, the outside world into his lung, what can you tell me about this pressure in the intrapleural space? If there's a hole from there to the air, it's going to be 760 millimeters of mercury all the time, right? And so when you get to this condition right here, now you have 760 millimeters of mercury, right? And there's 763 in here. Well, the lungs still won't deflate, but let's look at this condition here. All right, so during inspiration, this is the problem. Okay, so if the intrapleural space now is at 760 millimeters of mercury because there's a hole through the chest wall, so this number jumps from 754 to 760. The intrapulmonary pressure is 757, right? Then what happens to these volumes? Where's air going to go? Instead of going into the lungs, it's going to go into the intrapleural space. Right, as a result of that. And that's going to cause collapse of the lungs when that happens. Okay? Because this pressure is going to push up against the lungs and force a collapse of the lungs. And that is what we call a pneumothorax. Right? So this pleural space has to be closed off from the outside world in order to have normal breathing, normal inspiration and expiration. Okay, so that is all important stuff, to get air in and out of our lungs, because that's how gases are delivered. And as a matter of fact, that's a major way that even pH is maintained in your body. So these volumes in the lungs are very important to measure, right? And so we measure them with a method that we call spirometry. And the instrument that we use to measure lung volumes is called a spirometer. And we measure these volumes when somebody is breathing in different kinds of ways. Okay, there is some air that doesn't go, that does not undergo exchange because there are no alveoli in the larynx. There's no alveoli in the trachea. There's no alveoli in the bronchus. So when you inhale, all of those parts of your anatomy still contain inspired air, but they really don't help in getting any oxygen to your tissues because there's no doorway for exchange. We call those places the anatomic dead space, right? There's no gas exchange because there's no alveoli in those places. But what we're really interested in are the volumes inside the lungs. And we can see that really nicely on this diagram right here. Here is a graph of lung volume versus different phases of breathing. Okay, so lung volume increases as we go up the scale, lung volume decreases as we go back down. All right, so this line then represents the volume at the lungs at any particular time. And one of the things that you notice is what? Where does this line ever go to zero, like pressure inside of a ventricle? Do you see this line ever going to zero? This is a volume, don't forget. All right, so no matter if you're inspiring or expiring, there's always some air left inside the lungs, right? Just like there's always some blood left inside the heart after contraction. Right, this air that's left in the lungs is what we call the residual volume. And it does not exchange really with the atmosphere. It's just kind of like a dead volume inside of your lungs, right? Unless an elephant sits on your chest, then of course this volume would go away. All right. Under normal breathing conditions, we see air going in, air going out, air going in. We call this a tidal volume, right? And this tidal volume is maybe 700 milliliters. It's not very much. Okay, but notice that this tidal volume doesn't sit right down on top of the residual volume. It's kind of above the volume, the residual volume. All right? Which means that since there is additional volume between the end of a normal expiration and this residual volume, you can do what if you try really hard? You can even force more air out of your lungs, right? And we call that expiratory reserve. Right, so this tidal volume is during quiet breathing, but under forced breathing, then you can recruit the space for exchange by using some muscles in your body. All right, and then you can go back to normal breathing, get to the top of a normal inspiration, and you still have some capacity to inflate the lungs, right, up to the total lung capacity right here. Right, with forced inspiration, you can take a really deep breath, and that will reveal this inspiratory reserve volume. So you both have a reserve volume for expiration and a reserve volume for inspiration. So that you can now increase ventilation of the lungs by expiring more and inspiring even more. So from the bottom of the expiratory reserve volume to the top of the inspiratory reserve volume, and that also includes this tidal volume right here, that is your vital capacity. That's the amount of air that you can bring in and out of your lungs for gas exchange. So the ones that I would like for you to know, total lung capacity, that's pretty easy to see. Vital capacity is very important. And a capacity, any capacity that you see on this diagram right here, is a combination of some of these fundamental volumes. So what are some of the fundamental volumes? And they're not capacities. Residual volume, tidal volume, expiratory reserve volume, and inspiratory reserve volume. If we add any of these volumes together to get a measurement of something, that's going to be called what? A capacity. Right, so if you take tidal volume, add it to inspiratory reserve volume, that gives you inspiratory capacity. I'm not so concerned about these capacities except for this one right here, which is which one? Vital capacity, right. Okay, when somebody has lung disease, what happens? Well, usually what happens is that this residual volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The total lung volume pretty much stays the same. But this residual volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which means what to these other volumes? They have to shrink, right? So you lose vital capacity, especially expiratory reserve and inspiratory reserve volumes. The tidal volume might stay the same if you put your mind to it. So under quiet breathing, you might not notice any difference. But as the residual volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger, okay, let's say residual volume goes way up to here, now what happens? There is no inspiratory reserve volume, no expiratory reserve volume. And then you just have what? You're only existing on tidal volume, right? So you have no room for breathing, okay? No breathing room, as they say. Okay, so this is a typical kind of diagram that you'll see in any kind of physiology class. This would have been another nice thing to draw out in lab, but it is an exam figure, yeah. Total lung capacity, I think you have to adjust that for age. Total lung capacity decreases with age. We lose pulmonary function. And your question is, why are we interested in this? I mean, can you ever inhale completely to fill your lungs?
Yeah, or exhale.
You can't exhale completely, but you can inhale completely. Okay. Yeah, unless you get smushed, unless you get sit on by something really, really big. All right, so this residual volume you can never expel from your lungs, but you can inhale completely this inspiratory reserve. Okay? And I wanted to say something about that. I'll maybe try to think of what it was when I want to talk about it later on. Total lung capacity. Okay, so here's a good exam figure. Here's a table which just explains that graph. So I think we did a pretty good job explaining it already. But you can look at that on your own. All right, so what are some factors that affect gas exchange? What would be the first thing that would come to mind for gas exchange across a membrane? What does it have to have? Okay. Yeah, diffusion, but we're not really so interested or concerned with solutes. We're interested in pressures of various kinds of molecules, right? So a pressure difference, definitely, will make a difference on how fast something exchanges because a concentration gradient does affect diffusion. So pressure, you should think of, is almost something like concentration. As the pressure of a gas increases, you could think that its concentration is increasing. That's a valid way of thinking of that. Okay. What's another thing that it can affect gas exchange? How about the size of the doorway? Absolutely, right? So if you have alveoli that are nice and healthy, they can expand a lot, right? And make sure that they don't collapse inappropriately. So the surface area of the lungs is very important. All right, so how do we measure that something that we could kind of think of as concentration of these different like solutes that are in a gas? Well, we think of them in terms of partial pressures, not concentration. So partial pressure is the pressure of that particular gas in a mixture, right? And we can think of it as producing a pressure that's independent of anything else that's inside that volume of gas. And so that leads us to Dalton's law that just says that if we have a mixture of gases in a container, the total pressure in that container is going to be equal to the sum of all of the partial pressures of all of the different kinds of gases that are in there. All right, so we have the Earth with atmospheric pressure. And what are some things that contribute to atmospheric pressure? Well, we want to look at the partial pressures for everything that's in air. What do we know that's in air? Well, we know oxygen is in air. All right, so oxygen has some kind of partial pressure that's going to be added to atmospheric pressure. We know there's some CO2, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere, so we have to look at the partial pressure of that CO2 and add it to the PO2 to get a better understanding of atmospheric pressure. But there's also another gas. And actually, this is the major component in the air that we breathe, and that is nitrogen. Okay, and nitrogen is a nice inert compound that doesn't help or hurt anything that we're doing under most circumstances. Okay, but since it's in here, we have to consider its partial pressure. And also, when water evaporates, guess what it becomes? It becomes a gas, right? Just water vapor is a gas, and it has a partial pressure as well. All right, so we add all of these things together, and we're going to get really close to 760 millimeters of mercury, which is typically what we believe to be atmospheric pressure. All right, so gas exchange from air into an alveolus and back and forth again is driven by something you consider to be like concentration gradient, but it's going to be what? Partial pressure differences, right, between the alveoli and capillaries. All right, so here we have air in the alveoli. So what do we see? We see that the total pressure of inspired air is 760. At the end of inspiration, right, or at the end of expiration, it's going to be 760 inside the alveolus as well. And then we can look at these different partial pressures. All right, CO2 in air is almost zero, but not quite. Right, it's 0.3 millimeters of mercury in the air around us. All right, but in the alveolar air, typically we're going to find 40 millimeters of mercury. All right, so which way is CO2 going to have a tendency to go? From high pressure to low pressure. So that's a very good reason for CO2 to leave our body as a result of that. Okay, and oxygen. What about oxygen? Inspired air, it's 159. In the alveolus, it's 105. So that's a nice force that's driving air inside our bodies. Right? So there's these pressure differences, but again, you could almost think of these as being like a concentration gradient. Okay, and nitrogen, we're really not so concerned about what it is. And water is variable, right? If it's very low humidity, water vapor inside your lungs is going to be constant at 47 millimeters of mercury. Nevertheless, if we add all of these things up together, the total pressure, okay, is going to be 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so these are some concepts that we're going to use in the upcoming slides. All right, so here is a nice diagram. And we see part of the respiratory tree. And here we have a bronchiole, right? And then we got a terminal bronchiole right here. And we have a respiratory bronchiole. These bronchioles don't have cartilage around them, but you do see smooth muscle, right? So, there are some parts of the respiratory tree that does have cartilage around them. Anybody remember some components of your airways that have cartilage? Trachea has cartilage, so C-shaped cartilages. The larynx has cartilage, right? And I think I mentioned this before, but remember to exhale air, you have to have high pressure inside your lungs, inside your thoracic cavity compared to atmospheric pressure to get air flowing out. Right, so we decrease the volume of our lungs, increasing the pressure, air flows out, as long as what? These tubes are open. Right, so if we compress our lungs, increase the pressure inside our thoracic cavity, if the trachea didn't have cartilages, guess what would happen? It would collapse. And when it collapsed, what would happen to flow through that particular tube? Yeah, it's just radius to the fourth power, just like for a blood vessel. So it would decrease drastically. So you would never be able to exhale. And if you can't exhale, then guess what? You can't inhale air, right? So that's why those tubes are open. These have smooth muscles on them to regulate flow into these different chambers over here. Okay, these different alveolar sacs. We'll see why that is in a second. All right, so these are microscopic tubes, and anything that doesn't have cartilage is what we're going to call a bronchiole. Okay, and in particular, I see a respiratory bronchiole right in this region, okay, because gas exchange can take place, because on this bronchiole, what does it have? I see an alveolus right here. So an alveolus is that structural and functional unit where gas exchange takes place, and surrounding every alveolus is this capillary network. Right. And so this capillary, of course, is specialized for exchange, so gases can go from the alveolar air into the blood very easily because this is a huge doorway. I think we talked about this last time, but if we were to consider this an orange, right, every alveolus an orange, and peel the skin off of that orange or all these alveoli and lay it flat on a table, because you could do that after you peel it, how big would that tabletop be? If we were to measure the surface of all 300 million alveoli in your lungs. Half of a tennis court, that's right, we mentioned that last time. So that's a huge doorway. Because of all of these, you could almost consider these convolutions. All right, so that's a huge doorway, and these doorways are surrounded by capillaries for exchange. But there is something important that is missing from this illustration, that is not missing from the illustration in your anatomy book, and that is there's another network of substances on the outside surface of this alveolus. Does anybody picture in your mind what I'm trying to mention right now? There's a network of elastic fibers around every alveolus. So not just a network of capillaries, but there's a elastic network as well, which means once an alveolus is expanded, it will deflate passively because those elastic fibers get stretched. Okay. All right, so we're interested in knowing how oxygen gets into your body, right? And remember that there are two circulations, right? Blood is a connective tissue. It's going to connect your lungs to your big toe, your lungs to your brain, all those different places because of that particular kind of connective tissue. All right, but how many circulations are there in your body? Okay, you got systemic and you have pulmonary circulation, because how many sides of the heart do you have? Two. How many ventricles do you have? You got two, right? You got a right and a left ventricle. Okay, so there are basically two circulations, and the rate of blood flow through both circulations has to be equal, otherwise blood is going to pool in one circulation or another. And if that persists for a long period of time, that circulation that is kind of like grabbing onto that blood, not passing it through, gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then what happens? Well, then it explodes, and then you just find yourself in a big pool of blood someplace, right? So the circulation has to match up to each other. Okay. All right, but we know that a fluid will move from high pressure to low pressure, and that the resistance through the pulmonary circulation is very low compared to the resistance of the systemic circulation, right? Because of the length, for instance. All right, so pulmonary vascular resistance is low, which means then to keep the flow the same, what has to happen? The pressure has to be decreased, right? So the pressure through the pulmonary circulation is decreased compared to the systemic by a huge amount, right? It's about 15 millimeters of mercury, 100 millimeters of mercury for the systemic circulation. All right, but that has some good implications. That low pressure means that there's less net filtration through a capillary. There's less force that's forcing fluid out of a capillary into the tissue spaces. Right? So in your systemic circulation, you have a lot of fluid that's left over in your tissue spaces that you could be concerned with, but there's another kind of vascular system that helps in that regard. And what is that? Anybody remember what that is? It's kind of a dead-end circulation. It's not a complete circle circulation. It just starts in the tissue spaces, ends up in a vein, and those are your lymphatic vessels, right? So that lymphatic vessels help return all that excess fluid back to the circulation in your systemic areas, right? But in the lungs, you don't necessarily need to have that because you have less pressure forcing fluid out, and that then reduces the effects of pulmonary edema. Right? Edema just means what? When a lot of fluid gets built up in tissue spaces. So that usually does not happen, okay, as long as your blood is pretty normal. What is the component in blood that acts as a solute that draws fluid back into that distal end of a capillary? Because water is going to go from high concentration to low. And when you have a lot of this particle in your blood, that decreases the water concentration. So it kind of like just sucks water back in because of the concentration gradient at the distal end of a capillary. It's a protein that your liver makes, and that is albumin. Albumin. So that prevents edema in most parts of your body, including the lungs. All right, so now here is something that is kind of interesting, and that is, remember when we were talking about blood flow through a capillary in, say, a muscle. Okay, so think of a muscle, and now let's take that muscle that's quiet and start to exercise it and rely on some of your understanding of cellular respiration. What's happening biochemically inside that muscle? When it's exercising, what is it doing? It's using up ATP and producing ADP. Okay, but if blood can get into that muscle, all right, what's going to happen? Oxygen is going to go to a mitochondria. Mitochondria is going to take that ADP, combine it with an inorganic phosphate, make another ATP out of it, as long as you have glucose available, right, and oxygen. But when a muscle is contracted, it can't get oxygen because blood can't get in there. Then what happens? You can still make some ATP by what kind of mechanism? Anaerobic glycolysis, right? And what's an end product of glycolysis? Lactic acid. So when a muscle is exercising, okay, blood can't get in there. ADP concentration rises. The acidity does what? Becomes more acidic. And another compound that builds up is lactic acid. All right, so in that muscle circulation, when those and oxygen concentration decreases, right? So when oxygen decreases and all those other compounds increase, it has an effect on the precapillary sphincter and also smooth muscle arterioles. What's the effect in normal systemic places? Okay, if you look at the chemicals that show that the muscle is exercising, like what? Increased lactic acid, increasing ADP, and increased acidity, these are all measures of activity of that muscle. What would you expect? Would you like your body to increase blood flow to that muscle or to decrease? Increase, right? So all those compounds cause dilation of the precapillary sphincter. That's what we call local control. Okay, and I think I drew it on the board. Your book doesn't do a really good job of that. But local control just means that the environment in that area regulates the diameter of that blood vessel so that if you have chemicals building up that signify what? High metabolic rate, those blood vessels are going to dilate to bring in oxygen, to bring in glucose, and to wash out, what? Lactic acid. Okay, so you get vasodilation in the systemic parts of your body with exercise.
So is that what happens when you get a muscle cramp?
When you get a muscle cramp? Yeah, so that muscle is contracted, blood can't get in there, right? So it can't wash away any of that lactic acid, can't change the pH, so lactic acid is building up, the pH is dropping very rapidly, and that's what causes pain. But you also, when that muscle contracts, it probably contracts completely, and that's going to pull on the tendons and ligaments, and that's going to feel uncomfortable too. But when you get a cramp, it probably feels real bad because of that ischemia, where you don't have perfusion of blood into that muscle. And that's pretty much true of all muscle, whether it's cardiac muscle, or smooth muscle, or skeletal muscle. Okay? You feel very uncomfortable. You're used to understanding that kind of pain from skeletal muscle. You're not so used to it if you have like a heart attack, right? Because we don't experience heart attacks. Or if you have a smooth muscle cramp. It's not quite the same. Indigestion usually maybe is due to acid reflux up into the esophagus, which may cause some stimulation of those smooth muscles right there. Okay, so for the systemic circulation, where we have low oxygen, what does that do to those precapillary sphincters? Where there's low oxygen, like in a muscle, what happens to that precapillary sphincter? It relaxes and dilates so that more oxygen can get to that tissue. That makes perfect sense. Okay. Now let's switch to the pulmonary circulation. And in anatomy, we saw that the systemic arteries are usually colored what? Red, because they're high in oxygen. And the veins in the systemic circulation are blue. Now what can you tell me about the pulmonary circulation? What about those colors for arteries and veins in the pulmonary circulation? Are they the same? They're flipped, right? So pulmonary artery colors are usually blue, meaning it's low in oxygen. That makes sense because that blood is an artery being taken away from the heart to go to the lungs to pick up oxygen. So that blood is low in oxygen, otherwise it shouldn't be going to the lungs. And after the lungs, it picks up oxygen and it becomes a vein because it's a vessel bringing blood back to the heart and it's loaded with oxygen. And usually we illustrate that with what kind of color? Well, when it's oxygenated, red. Yep, red. All right, so the colors of arteries and veins, when you compare systemic and pulmonary circulations, is what? Opposite. Right? And in anatomy, that's how we'd like to think of the umbilical circulation as well, through the placenta. Right? They're opposite. Right? Okay. So the pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to the systemic circulation, and that's especially true for that local control as well. All right, so let's follow this discussion. Let's go back to systemic. When oxygen decreases in a muscle, what happens to precapillary sphincters? They dilate to let blood in, right, to bring oxygen to that tissue. Okay, now what about the lungs? What happens to smooth muscle in the lungs? When you have low oxygen in the lungs, okay, should those bronchioles and the precapillary sphincter, should they dilate when you have low oxygen, like in the systemic circulation? But if you have low oxygen, yeah, you're right. If you have low oxygen in an alveolus, there's no reason to have blood go there because there's no oxygen to pick up. So in the lung, you have vasoconstriction to areas that have low oxygen, okay, which is opposite compared to the systemic, but in parts of the lung that have high oxygen, guess what happens? It vasodilates, so that blood goes to that part of the lung, right, so that exchange of oxygen can take place. So again, right, that ventilation perfusion changes in the lung. It's opposite compared to the systemic circulation. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense, right? There's no reason why blood should go to a part of the lung that is low in oxygen, okay? But there is good reason blood should go to some other part of your body, like a muscle, when it is low in oxygen, right? So the pulmonary and systemic circulations, in terms of local control, are opposite each other. That has some really fascinating consequences in a lot of people's lives. This figure I'm not so concerned about, but it just shows the ventilation perfusion ratio in different parts of the lung. It's better on the apical surfaces compared to the basal surfaces, but usually it's pretty constant, right, because of that local control within the lungs. All right. Well, I think I would like to talk about it because it's something people are beginning to realize as something that's really, really important. Okay. So let me see. Where do I want to start? Let's just say we have low oxygen in some part of the lung. If there's low oxygen, what's going to happen to precapillary sphincters? They're going to constrict because there's no reason why blood should go to that part of the lung because it has low oxygen, right? Unlike the systemic circulation. Okay. Well, there are some conditions where when somebody's sleeping, they stop breathing. Okay. Now, what happens to oxygen inside their lungs when you stop breathing? It goes way down. What happens to all those precapillary sphincters when oxygen goes way down when you stop breathing when you're sound asleep? They constrict. What happens to resistance when there's a big constriction in a blood vessel? It goes way up, right? The resistance goes way up. But remember, when resistance goes up, that will decrease the blood flow. But the blood flow should be the same between the systemic and pulmonary circulations. All right, so when somebody stops breathing, you get vasoconstriction. You need to maintain flow. What's the only way that your body can compensate for that? Increasing the pressure of the pulmonary circulation, right? So you get pulmonary hypertension as a result. And the lungs are very sensitive to pulmonary hypertension. They degrade, okay? And also, it can't compensate completely. So the right side of the heart has to work really, really hard. So we call it, what do we call that condition when you can't, when you stop breathing when you're sleeping? Yeah, sleep apnea, right? So sleep apnea, because the lungs work opposite compared to the systemic circulation, right? You get failure of the right side of the heart because it has to develop such high pressure to force blood through the lungs under those conditions of high resistance when you're not breathing. All right, so it's not really intuitive, so maybe you could follow my discussion. I'm not really sure, but it's a really curious effect. There's some other curious effects too, but your question.
With the increased pulmonary hypertension, is there an increased chance of pulmonary
edema? Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so that increases pulmonary edema, which then further decreases pulmonary function. All right, but there's something else too that happens as a result of sleep apnea. Doesn't necessarily relate to the lungs, but for instance, if somebody were to sneak up behind you and start to choke you, like what happens when you stop breathing at night, except nobody's choking you, you're just kind of doing that to yourself, okay, what response is that? Is that rest and digest or fight and flight? That's obviously fight and flight, right? So your sympathetic nervous system becomes activated when you can't breathe at night or when you stop breathing at night, and we know about mass activation of your sympathetic nervous. Everything receives that big sympathetic charge, right? And it might wake you up, but what happens to your heart rate? It goes way up, right? And of course, then your systemic blood pressure goes way up as well. So sleep apnea also produces systemic hypertension, right? And anything else that is related to increased sympathetic drive over time, right? And that could cause heart failure, and that pulmonary edema, eventually with somebody with sleep apnea, they'll need both a heart and lung transplant as a result. So that's a pretty serious condition to have sleep apnea, and people are just becoming aware of that. And it's pretty occult. People don't know that they're experiencing that. But they might have pretty much uncontrolled blood pressure, hypertension, and that could be a reason why that happens, right? So if somebody snores a lot at night, okay, and says that they're tired constantly during the day, like if they ever get into a traffic jam on the 405 freeway and they're not moving, they're not doing something, they fall asleep, then that's a really good sign that that's a good reason to be checked for sleep apnea, because it will kill the lungs, kill your heart, and all that kind of stuff just by cessation of breathing when you're sleeping. Yeah. Oh, it affects every part of your body in ways that we don't really understand. Yeah, it's just really kind of curious how it affects a lot of things. Yeah. Okay, so sleep apnea, pretty serious disease process. Okay, and because of that ventilation perfusion, how it happens in the lungs, right, then it really needs to be treated. And there's some really good treatments for sleep apnea today. Okay, so one of the things that sleep apnea affects are these centers in the brain that control respiration. Okay, and these centers, the respiratory centers, are in the medulla and the pons, just like the cardioregulatory center and the vasomotor center is in these areas, right? And reticular formation is in these areas. Well, there's three areas that we're sort of interested in. One is in the medulla, that's the rhythmicity center, right? The other two are in the pons. Those are the pneumotaxic and apneustic area. And I think the best way to think about this is that this rhythmicity center is acting like a pacemaker that you have in your heart. What's the pacemaker in your heart? The SA node, right? So this rhythmicity center, when you're not thinking about breathing, is going to cause just that normal rhythm of inspiration and expiration all on its own. It doesn't need, right, any kind of special thing to happen to it. But there are some special areas right here that can influence what the natural rate of rhythmicity is from the rhythmicity center. And that's the pneumotaxic and apneustic area. These two things are antagonistic to each other. One will stimulate inspiration, the other will inhibit inspiration. Right? And I guess probably you would expect that to be the case. Right? So where do we see that? The apneustic center promotes inspiration by stimulating the inspiratories in that rhythmicity center. The pneumotaxic center antagonizes this apneustic center, so in a sense, it inhibits inspiration. All right, so pneumotaxic, the bottom line, inhibits inspiration. The apneustic center stimulates inspiration. That adds some control onto just the normal rate of breathing that is controlled by the rhythmicity center right here, rhythmicity center. So this apneustic and pneumotaxic area are kind of acting like what compared to how you regulate your heart rate and force of contraction of the heart? I hear, but you weren't really forceful with that. It's, these areas right here are acting like what? The parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, right? But they're not really that way, but it's set that antagonism is built into the system so that your body has precise control and balance over ventilation. Right. And so if somebody has a stroke, which then kills some part of the medulla or the pons right here, then you would expect them to have ventilation problems or breathing problems. Right? And maybe some of these areas are destroyed, like this rhythmicity area, so unconscious breathing is destroyed completely. Right? But that's sort of okay, because how else can you breathe? Even when you're sleeping. Not when you're, for instance, when you're awake. How can you breathe? Well, just using the higher centers in your brain, you can go like that, and you can hold your breath. So since the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, it's under voluntary control. So if there's damage to these areas right here, somebody with damage to these areas will have to make a conscious effort to inspire every time they need to take a breath, which is pretty scary. I wouldn't like to do that. So means as soon as you fall asleep, definitely you stop breathing. So when you fall asleep, what do you need to be on? A ventilator, right? Does anybody know the name of that disease? It's called Odin's curse. Okay, it's not very common, okay? Thank goodness. Odin's curse, yeah. You could do a Google on that and find out why it was named that. It's interesting why it was named that. Okay, so ventilation is a way to adjust various kinds of chemical compounds in your body, like, for instance, CO2 and oxygen. Right, and we know how important oxygen is for respiration, right? Mitochondria need it to make ATP. ATP is necessary because remember, how many, if we cut off blood supply to mitochondria in your brain, how long a period of time do you have? How much consciousness time do you have? About 2 or 3 seconds, right? Then you lose consciousness. And then after what period of time does the brain actually die? 2 to 3 minutes, right? So you need a constant supply of oxygen to the brain to stay healthy. So what compound do you think would be important to monitor all the time to make adjustments in ventilation? Is it CO2 or oxygen? Okay. Well, you guys have been studying, right? I always thought, well, for sure it's got to be oxygen. But that is not the case. The most sensitive chemical, or the chemical that produces the greatest changes, most important for regulating ventilation, is CO2 and not oxygen. That's kind of counterintuitive, but we're going to see probably why that is. All right, so on this figure, I see the brain, I see some blood vessels and the heart. Okay, the heart probably is not so important in this discussion, but these blood vessels are, because there are certain kinds of receptors in the carotid sinus right here and also on the arch of the aorta. I think we looked at these in terms of the baroreceptor reflex. So there are pressure sensors here, which are just stretch receptors, but there are also chemoreceptors in these areas as well. Okay, and these chemoreceptors can monitor CO2 and pH and oxygen depending on where they are. There's also chemoreceptors in the medulla. All right, so the ones in the medulla we call central receptors, because what part of the nervous system are they in? The central nervous system. That's why they're called central receptors. But these down over here are what we call the peripheral receptors. okay, because they're kind of out in the periphery inside your body. All right, so automatic breathing is influenced by these chemoreceptors that monitor the concentration of CO2, which is a gas, so we're going to just call that pCO2, and PO2, that's the concentration in a sense of oxygen. But pH is what? That's not partial pressure. This is what? Minus the log of the inverse of the hydrogen ion concentration, which you had to calculate at one point in time, right? So we call that pH. So, which is kind of strange, because as the hydrogen ion increases, acidity increases, but what about this pH number? Yeah, it goes down, right? There's an inverse relationship between this pH number and hydrogen ion concentration. All right, so these central, we talked about in the medulla, peripheral, here in the carotid bodies. So how does this work? Okay, these chemoreceptors can influence the rhythmicity center. Right, depending on the how oxygen, carbon dioxide, and pH is moving. And this rhythmicity center in the medulla then controls automatic breathing. It sends action potentials down the spinal cord to motor neurons. Right? Oh, what nerve leaves? What nerve leaves the central nervous system to get to the diaphragm, which is the most important muscle for inspiration? You all know this. But we're talking about a muscle that's a skeletal muscle. Vagus, I think, is more autonomic. Okay, so it's just going to be a nerve that carries a lot of somatic motor impulses. Okay, and it has three origins. The origins are C3, 4, and 5. Maybe this is ringing a bell. Some people learn this little saying. C3 and 4 and 5 keeps you alive because it allows you to breathe. And the nerve that comes from the cervical nerve plexus at those three locations is the phrenic nerve. Anybody shaking your head going, oh yeah, I remember that, not too many people. Phrenic nerve is the nerve that goes to the diaphragm. And it comes from the cervical nerve plexus, C3, 4, and 5. Which is the reason why if you experience a cervical spine injury and it breaks the spinal cord above that level, then you can't breathe because there's no input to the phrenic nerve. Okay. All right. So what are the effects of blood pCO2 and pH on ventilation? Well, guess what? Woo, this is terrible. You got to come back. But at least you're going to come back this week sometime. It's not over a weekend. Okay. But this is where we're going to start next time. Okay. And we still got a little bit more to talk about in respiratory chapter. Okay. Sign-in sheet is going around. And I'll see you Thursday. And I think it will really be helpful to come Thursday. If you're thinking of not coming Thursday, it's probably really good that you come to lecture on Thursday.